Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Glasses Manifesto.
When you were in the Army, I guess they taught you to use guns and yeah. That sort of thing. Did you enjoy that combat training?
Yes, I did. I signed up for infantry. Even before I had any real interest in guns, because I never even handled a real gun until I got into the Army. My father never owned any. He was against guns.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 6, God, Guns, and Girls. Act 1, Good Morning, South Korea. Just 1 month after David Berkowitz graduated from high school in June of 1971, he joined the Army, and after completing boot camp, was sent not to the boiling cauldron of war in Southeast Asia that his lifelong death wish so desperately craved, but instead to a quiet outpost in South Korea, where he was trained as a radio operator and placed in a patrol vehicle along the Incheon River, where he saw little to no action. Quote, "We saw North Koreans, but while there was potential for action, we never had any," end quote. Lack of violence notwithstanding, David Berkowitz took to military life like a duck to water, and it was almost as if things were going to get better for a change.
He proved competent as a soldier, and he made reasonably good rank in a short time.
Jack asked David about his military record.
Oh, it was all right. I got into trouble twice, but nothing, you know, serious. One time I didn't make formation in time, you know. And that was, so I got an Article 15, and it was like a $15 fine. Another time I took some food out of the mess hall. Me and a couple of guys came back from the village in town, and it was like almost midnight when the rest of the city, you know, the town's closed down, they have the curfew there. We were all kind of high, you know, not really bad, but just we were in a what do you call it type mood. We wanted to raise hell, you know what I'm saying? So we passed by the mess hall, we saw an open window there. And then without really much afterthought, we just, we hopped into the window to see if there was any food in the refrigerator. You know, it's a mess hall building and the windows aren't barred up or anything, so this window was open. We hopped in, but then one guy, you know, we went to the refrigerator and it was like the bricks of cheese, the big long bricks of cheddar cheese and stuff. We took a whole brick, we were ready to take it back to the barracks. Well, one guy turned on the lights. The mess hall only had like small fire exit lights on. And it was, we could see, but this guy is stupid. He turned on the lights and the whole mess hall lit up. This is a pitch black, you know, compound. There's really no lights there. And the whole area lit up with the lights from the mess hall shining out. Of course, this little gully is where the mess hall, the guys who work in the mess hall, where their barracks are. As soon as they saw the lights come on, they all ran over the side and everybody. And then we were coming out the window with the cheese. So that was how I got in trouble in the Army. Yes.
In a scene that could only have been pulled straight out of a military sitcom, David and a few friends, drunk and stoned, broke into the mess hall and made out with a block of cheese. A pretty harmless infraction by any stretch of the imagination. But that wasn't his only noted fracas while serving as an enlisted man. Another time he missed a bus back to the base, officially changing his status to AWOL, absent without leave. And when he returned, in exchange, was busted down in rank from E4 to E3. David Berkowitz had received a consequence for his actions for maybe the first time in his adult life.
Being in the Army was, for the first time, he had rules and regulations which he had to follow, and if he did not, there were immediate, swift, physical consequences. The Army was the authoritarian father that he needed and really craved, but never had.
Despite the missed bus and the impromptu cheese party, David Berkowitz, for the first time in his life, was doing reasonably well.
He was competent and he was reasonably reliable in whatever duties he was assigned. But I think just as in high school, he could be a good student. He could almost always pass any course, but it had to be under some kind of threat. Like in high school, you aren't going to graduate unless you go to summer school. And in the Army, you're going to lose one of your stripes and be demoted if you don't show up on time and do a credible job of keeping records or cleaning guns at the armory or whatever kind of things you have to do routinely on a military base.
Didn't you have some sort of structure?
Yeah, to a degree, but not as much. You had free time basically in the evenings. When you weren't in the field on maneuvers, around 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, you were done. You finished the evening meal and then you were free. You showered up, you got your pass, and you went into the village and you partied. There was a tremendous amount of irresponsibility with that, you know. No real discipline, no sense of discipline at all. If there's any discipline they try to instill in you in the daytime, watching you around in formation or something, you lost it when you went out there and you got drunk on that cheap Korean wines they had and all the grass that was available, you know, and all the women. There were fights in the villages all the time. The police, the MPs used to walk in full force through the little villages because the soldiers would always be fighting. So it was, you know, there wasn't that much of a sense of discipline, really.
During the day, David Berkowitz lived the regimented life of an Army man. But at night, he did what everybody else did. He clocked out and headed to the nearby village where he dove headlong into a world of drugs and alcohol, leaving far behind him the anti-drug stance he'd adopted in high school. David Berkowitz was fitting in. He was a changed man. Quote, I got there in the unit and I was really, you know, just out of training. I was really gung-ho, super straight. Everyone who got there changed. Wow. When we got exposed to everything, everyone changed. Almost everybody went crazy. End quote.
You mentioned that you used to smoke dope when you were in Korea. When did you start, in boot camp or?
When I got overseas.
Did you ever do any acid or?
I tried that, yeah, a few times.
Did you have trouble with it or did you handle it pretty well?
Handle it well. But I didn't really care for it. I didn't like that feeling of being helpless and letting your mind drift, everything being distorted.
Did you ever do any heroin or?
No, nothing hard.
Any other psychedelics like mescaline or?
Yeah, about 2 times.
You don't feel like that? Disjointed you in any way?
No, not at all. Nothing.
It's been too much of a scapegoat.
Sure. I stopped that. I only did it for about 8 months while I was in Korea. I was in Korea for 13 months. I only did it for about 8 months. And in the last 3 or 4 months, it just like the novelty of the thing wore off, you know. That was like part of the rebelliousness that all the soldiers go through, you know, the defiance of the authorities.
In the end, drugs just weren't his bag.
He says he had experiences there with psychedelic drugs, which were fleeting. Didn't seem to be either an alcoholic or inclined to any kind of addiction.
Act 2. Guns. Although it wasn't in the form of a life-altering acid trip or a debilitating drug addiction, the military was to have a substantial effect on David Berkowitz and his murderous actions to come. It was in the military that David Berkowitz was introduced to guns.
Being in the Army, it had a good and bad effect. The good effect was making him feel like he could pull his own weight, given the properly regimented situation. The bad effect was Army particularly involved guns, and he learned and was interested in learning about firearms and joined infantry as opposed to applying to a clerical school or become a cook or something that would give him a trade after he got out of the Army.
When you were in the Army, I guess they taught you to use guns and that sort of thing. Did you enjoy that combat training?
Yes, I do. I signed up for infantry even before I had any real interest in guns, because I never even handled a real gun until I got into the Army. My father never owned any. He was against guns.
His only interaction with guns prior to the Army that I know of was the dart gun that the psychologist put in his hands when he was 9 or 10 years old and told him to shoot a doll and think of it as the person who he felt his hostility toward at that moment. So he would shoot little Jeffrey over and over because Jeffrey used to make fun of him for being adopted and beat him up.
Having grown up in an anti-gun household in a city where guns are and pretty much always have been heavily regulated against, David Berkowitz had never had anything to do with guns, didn't know anything about them, didn't know how to hold or even fire one. Now he was getting free, round-the-clock, hands-on training courtesy of the U.S. government, and he turned out to be a fairly decent shot. Despite initially failing his marksman test during boot camp at Fort Dix, he eventually qualified as a sharpshooter with an M16, a rating which ranks between marksman and expert. So, not too bad. David Berkowitz was proficient with a firearm, an implement of death, and for a chubby kid who had never been proficient at anything and who had always felt completely powerless, that was a game changer. David Berkowitz caught gun fever.
When you are in the military, particularly a combat unit as he was, you are taught, it is drilled into your head that your gun is everything. You never become separated from your gun. You have to know how to take it apart in the middle of the night, in the dark, clean it, keep it in good working order, know where all the safety features are and how to get it and use it at a moment's notice. Your gun becomes your spouse. To be thought of as an unattached part of your anatomy. It was just a matter of time before he made the connection between his gun and using the gun to project the animosity he felt toward young women. The gun gave him a convenient, impersonal way to release all of his anger and possibly some sexual frustration as well.
Jack asks David if he felt that his time in the military informed his relationship with the guns that he would eventually turn on innocent people.
Can you in any way say that military training and handling a firearm gave you confidence to start stockpiling the weapons?
Well, I would make a lot of American Legion guys angry in the area, you know. But, well, it might be a carryover, you know. I'd say yes.
It was official. Isolated loner David Berkowitz, with a lifetime of anger and frustration under his belt, was now locked and loaded and headed into the future, destination unknown. His adopted father, Nat, for one, may have had just a tiny glimpse of what was to come. Despite the distant relationship between father and son, David dutifully wrote Nat twice a month on average while in the military. In these letters, David often complained about one of his superior officers and expressed a fear that he would be court-martialed. What this was about or why he felt this way has been lost to history, but what we do know is that Nat sensed that David was losing his gung-ho attitude about the military, and even worse, feared that if David was ever in a combat situation, he might try to kill his superior officer. Quote, "At the time, I was really gung-ho. At other times, I felt I was going to revolt against them. In Korea, there was no morale. Everybody was against the lifers. Everybody was radical. Everybody wanted to revolt against the United States." End quote. But his adoptive father, Nat, wasn't the only person David wrote while he was in the military. He also wrote letters to his old flame, Iris Gerhardt, back in Co-op City. And in his letters to her, he seemed to put an even finer point on it. Quote, "I'm not really unhappy at all that I enlisted, even though life is very hard. They taught me how to fight. They taught me about weapons, demolition, riot control, self-defense. All of these courses will come in handy one day. I plan to use them, and it isn't going to be in the way the lifers want me to use them. I'll use these courses, these tactics, to destroy them, the way they destroyed millions of people through the wars they started. One day, there will be a better world." End quote. Act 3. Girls. Private rebellious confessions aside, David had, at least on the surface, entered quote-unquote polite society for the first time ever as a basically competent soldier in the U.S. Army. So I guess it seemed as good a time as any for David Berkowitz to have his first sexual experience with a lady.
Did you ever have a meaningful relationship with a woman?
No, but I'd appreciate it if you don't say that now. Okay. That's for another time. But I haven't. It's not that I'm impotent or anything. It's just that I've never hit it off, you know.
You aren't homosexual?
No.
Did you have many sexual relationships when you were...
Not that many, you know. Mainly when I was overseas, I had a lot.
Did you feel guilty about them?
Well, yeah. They were meaningless, though, you know, because women only talk broken English and they couldn't understand much of what you were saying. You know, all they wanted was your money. It was, you know, you want cheap. You know, all they used to go up to you was, they used to stand on the corners like in Korea, you know, and say, "Good time, Gia, good time," and then they try to pull you, you know. And then you realize that that's all they want is just for you to have like a good time. It's a meaningless relationship.
David would later tell a psychiatrist that he lost his virginity in Korea at age 19. Quote, "The first time I had sex was in Korea. There were prostitutes in the village if you wanted. It only cost a couple of dollars, but you had to stay clean. It was important to me. You could only go so far with them. They were willing. We lived like millionaires there. Every GI, we had so much money. The women wanted so little. We really partied." End quote.
The only interactions that he spoke of with women during his military service was prostitutes that he picked up, at least one of whom he befriended and even lived for a time off base with in South Korea.
Did you have a regular girlfriend over there?
At the time I did, Miss Chair, yeah. For the last 4 months before I was ready to leave, I stayed with her. She was very nice. They never wanted much money, you know, but she was attractive, too. Mm-hmm. She was one of the older hookers, you know, maybe 32 or something.
A real old,
man. Well, by about 35 or 40, they're all dead. They're all died off, you know.
By his account, David stayed with Miss Chat for his last 4 months in Korea, in a sort of amorphous boyfriend, girlfriend, sex worker, John type capacity. Sex worker or not, Miss Chat was someone David Berkowitz spent time with and seemed to get along with, at least for a while. And that's a pretty big deal for David.
She was nice. She was the best woman I ever, you know, met out there. She knew a lot of English too, broken English, and you could talk to her. The others sometimes knew nothing, you know. they give the money, they just spread their legs, they don't know what to say, and you know. It's weird, I could never hurt anybody that I knew personally, you understand what I'm saying? Once I started a relationship with that person, even if it was a casual conversation, I could never hurt them directly, you know.
Despite this thin layer of what could possibly be referred to as functional behavior floating thinly on the surface, a cauldron of animosity bubbled underneath.
Did you feel spiteful toward them, or did you feel like you were superior to them? Was there any time that you ever wanted to do any sort of violence to them?
I wouldn't say violence, you know, but it's easy to get angry at them because they were like leeches, you know. As soon as you walked out the gate, they had one hand around your crotch, you know, another hand in your pocket. You have to look down at them. I did, you know. Some of them were really attractive and nice, but a lot of them were, you know, really terrible life to live.
Did you ever go with one of them and not pay? Did you?
No, I paid. When it comes to, I never tried to beat them out of money and things, you know.
You never got violent with them?
No.
These prostitutes were convenient objects that he could use to explore something within himself, pay them, and out the door. But he also carried some guilt from that. Wherever it came from, a lot of guys who can't form meaningful relationships for whatever reason think of sex as something dirty, something that you should be ashamed of.
That was David to a T.
He felt a degree of pity for them, maybe empathize with them a bit as outsiders, albeit of the opposite sex. And it was probably easier for him to engage in a sexual relationship with people that he felt were even more damaged than he was by virtue of their life circumstances.
Whatever the reasons, the sex worker John relationship seemed to work for him, at least more than any other interaction he'd ever had with the opposite sex, which, granted, isn't saying much. Still, it was something. Unlike in the US, where he felt expected to marry someone and raise a family, in South Korea there was no such expectation, and beyond that, it was a culturally appropriate occurrence within the impromptu economy of the base. He didn't have to look on it as dirty or inappropriate due to its commonality in that context, and thus it became a viable option. He also didn't have to earn the relationship in any sort of social way. He was familiar with being unsuccessful in that department, so this was a welcome departure. In Korea, he didn't have to be charming. He didn't have to be funny, and more importantly, he didn't have to form any kind of meaningful bond with anyone, which meant he didn't have to turn in any of the loneliness and isolation he prized above all else. It was an exchange that worked for him in several ways, and as a result, David Berkowitz, of all people, got laid and became a conscientious objector.
Were there ever any blood overtones to your anger, or were you ever angry against America or capitalism or anything like that?
Well, when I was in the Army, I sort of became like a conscientious objector thing, you know. I wanted to. I was against principles of fighting and things. It was, you know, I was just going through that period. But that didn't last too long.
David's indoctrination to guns and girls complete, it was just after Christmas, in January of 1973, that David was transferred to Fort Knox, Kentucky, where he would spend the rest of his time in the military. Just before he left, in a general rating, dated March 24th, David was said to have, quote, been in this unit for over 1.5 years and has proved himself to be an outstanding and dependable soldier. He is enrolled in an education program to better himself and improve his performance, end quote. Shielded by his innocent appearance and outwardly docile behavior once again, nobody seemed aware of the monster that was growing inside him, except for maybe his father, Nat, who he was still writing letters to on the reg. Quote, Dad, although I'm your only son, you must admit we've never been close. Actually, it's all my fault. I know I often hurt you, but I didn't know better. I didn't mean to do all the things I did because I've always loved you and Mommy. I just didn't know how to say it. I know I was adopted, but I'm grateful for you because you gave me all you could. The love you and Mom gave me was more than I deserved. When you married, I was happy, although I never expressed it. I was cruel to her. I didn't know why. I'm really very grateful to her because she has given you a new life. After Mom died, you became a vegetable, Dad. I felt sorry for you because you didn't deserve it. I just can't explain my ideas and my philosophies to you. You wouldn't understand. It's all too deep. To be honest with you, I have never really told you anything about myself. I really can't now. But trust me, please, everything is fine. I hope to see you soon. Just be happy and please try to forget about me, Dad. Make believe you don't have a son, please. It's better this way because we may not see each other for a long time. I hope things are okay in the store. I'm sorry that I can't live up to your expectations. I'm sorry that I'm nothing in society. That is, I feel sorry for you because you don't see my point. I'm happy with the way I see things. It's wonderful. You know, Dad, you may as well be honest with yourself. You know you can be just as happy without me around. I've been a burden to you all your life. well, I won't be anymore. So please try to forget me, Dad. Please, it will be easier on you. I'm very content with my thoughts. Peace to you. Love to you. All of you. Sincerely, Dave. End quote. I highly doubt receiving a letter like this from your son would make Nat or any father feel better. It's obviously a deeply disturbing letter from a significantly troubled person, and I'm sure it only made the poor guy feel even worse and worried for his son. Still, David had, in South Korea, found a sort of relationship, held a job, and managed his own way in the world at least for a time. But now his time in Korea was coming to a close, and he was headed for Kentucky, where he would come face to face with the almighty creator himself, and along with him, the devil.
I think sincerely during his military time, he was trying to sort through his sexuality. He was trying to figure out who he was, searching for some identity and some group that he could feel comfortable and would be willing to accept him. And that happened later when he was transferred from Korea to guard duty at Fort Knox, Kentucky, and he fell in with a group of evangelicals who are always looking for somebody like him to sell their snake oil to.
Act 4. God. When David Berkowitz arrived at Fort Knox, Kentucky, he was done with girls and he was done with drugs. It was time, as he saw it, to start a new chapter. Quote, when I got back, I still had 18 months to do at Fort Knox. At Fort Knox, I didn't touch nothing. I was clean. Korea. That was the right place for drugs. All my time at Fort Knox, I was an A-number-1 soldier. I didn't use drugs. Just a couple of pills, occasionally. Maybe once a month, someone would have pot. It was very straight down there. You couldn't socialize. Louisville had bars, but Knox itself was a dry town. Elizabethtown, the other town, would have lots of booze, places all along Interstate 65. The guys used to drink a lot. I didn't have much money, so I couldn't go out like that much. I spent a lot of time on post, doing nothing, end quote.
I was a clerk. My last 18 months of service, when I got to Fort Knox, they only had a small infantry unit there, and they were all filled up. So they asked me if I could type, and I said yes, and they switched me over to a training unit, a basic training unit, and I was a clerk there, a permanent party clerk, and I did all the typing and paperwork on the job training. And to this day, I carry over most of my filing habits, like upstairs in my cell, for all the files and legal work and things, all arranged neat in the brown folders, and you know, I learned how to type, which I never knew before I went into the Army. And so I guess there are a lot of things that carry over, and you're not even aware of it.
And so it was, as a stone-cold, sober office clerk at Fort Knox with a lot of time on his hands, that David Berkowitz went looking for a new pastime, and as a result, was first introduced to Christianity in a major way. Quote, I began searching for a kind of religion at Fort Knox. There was an emptiness there, you know, with God, the meaning of life. I used to read a lot, soul-searching, you know. They had guys in the barracks, like really Christian. They used to go to church all the time. One of them, John Almond, used to ask if I wanted to go along. One day I did. I went to church. The service was really uplifting. Men, women, children, singing, holding hands. I never felt anything like that before in my life. I considered converting. I wanted to go to church. I used to go there quite a bit for a time. But not to lose my Jewishness. I mean, I still wanted to be a Jew, but I didn't want to miss church either. I finally converted. End quote. In the end, David Berkowitz's long desire to be accepted by the Gentiles around him won out over his lackluster commitment to Judaism he had held his entire life, and he was baptized on May 18, 1974 at the First Baptist Church. Deep down, he was conflicted. Quote, I went through the thing. They wanted to dunk you in the water. I went through it because you're supposed to. If you want to get in there, you know, join. I didn't want to lose my Jewishness, but again, I wanted to be with these people. I told them I was Jewish. It didn't matter. What they wanted me to say was like the minister, he was the Lord, you say I do. It was a very warm feeling standing there. They accept you. They crowd around. I wanted to accept them. I knew that I accepted Jesus. I was giving up my Jewish religion, but I didn't think it was related. I'm still of Jewish blood. After the baptism, the group accepted me, end quote. David Berkowitz was now a Christian, washed in the blood of the Lamb, a bride of Christ, as it were. But as a bride of Christ, there was still one more entity he was due to meet, and that was the devil.
This was a church you were going to when you were in the Army?
Yeah. Beth Haven Baptist Church. I got involved in that thing, you know. I was lonely. So I just got a couple of guys, these religious guys from the South down at Fort. And I went off there to, go to the services. And they were really hooked up with this devil thing. You know, they spent more time preaching on the devil than they did and what was wrong with the world and what was good about it.
Now, being a Jewish guy from the South Bronx, the idea of salvation was a new one. Judaism doesn't really work that way. You aren't saved per se. I mean, you are encouraged to live a godly life in accordance with tradition, but it's not like your soul is ever at risk of eternal damnation or anything like that. You're already good. You're Jewish. You're one of God's chosen people. And due to that, the idea of spiritual forces duking it out over the fate of your eternal soul was a concept David had never really come across before. However, it was definitely a concept that would have an absolutely massive, although pretty much wholly negative, effect on his life going forward. He would later say of his time in the Baptist church, quote, "They had a bad effect on my life and mind," end quote.
I've never heard of anything about demons before. In New York, you don't hear that, at least not where I live. And then when the Southern guys came along, first began to hear words like the devil and the demon and church thing to reinforce that. Because I always had an interest in, like, the supernatural, because I was always a horror fan. I used to have nightmares from watching horror movies. And this devil thing you heard in these churches, this fundamentalist church, you know, they were just, like, reinforced all that, you know. Suddenly there was an archenemy in the world, an invisible being creating havoc.
And just like that, a world of real-life devils and demons entered the picture for David Berkowitz.
It was fire and brimstone, the devil being personified as a reason for all of the darkness that he had sensed within himself since childhood. And more than being about love and peace and the values that Jesus Christ came to earth to impart, according to the Christian religion officially, it was all about Satan and doing bad and being forgiven. And therefore, somehow, doing bad was okay. Because even though God was going to punish you, you just go and pray and seek forgiveness and put some donations into the offering plate. And it was okay. I mean, it somehow legitimized the whole concept of evil for the first time. The devil, to him, that was a great thing for his, all the swirling, chaotic darkness in his mind to wrap around. And that was the reason the devil made him do it.
This was the devil's role on earth: to influence your behavior and tempt you towards sin so that ultimately he can drag your soul down to hell. Meaning, if you do wrong, it's the devil's influence, not your own will, that caused those things to happen. It wasn't you, it was the devil working through you. And not only that, if you did give in and commit a sin in a moment of weakness, then you could get down on your knees and pray it all away, and God would forgive you. David had never heard that before, and it had an oddly profound way of legitimizing everything he felt inside. In other words, it seemed like a pretty damn good deal to Dave.
The whole satanic concept and blaming the devil to David Berkowitz for the first time gave him a reason for his badness.
So like a foreign contaminant being introduced to a new population, the ideology of Christian sin and forgiveness would prove a toxic doorway to future violence in the psyche of David Berkowitz.
And so it began to, unconsciously at first, I began, anything that I did wrong, I began to lay blame to him, you know, just his meeting or his team of demons.
The devil made me do it.
Yeah, it's like the guilt. I don't know what the words are. Like you take the guilt and you
transfer it.
Yeah. You know, some got to a point where all my guilt was just being redirected to these beings, you know. And it's easy to find us to blame everybody for their own sins, you know. Oh, you've been, yes, you sinned, but you were tempted by the devil. You gave in to the lusts of the flesh, but the devil had tempted you, you see. So, and then when you say that, you're lessening the person's guilt because, well, it's not a real fault. You got to realize that there's an evil being out there who's tempting you, you know. And then you look at an ordinary person, what the heck would the devil want with them anyway, you know? You realize that, you know, the devil, you know, then every time I would do something wrong, like even masturbation or something, you know, that I feel guilty, and but oh, the devil was tempting me with these putting evil thoughts in my head.
It all just sort of clicked. The devil was inside his mind, putting these ideas in his head. And not only that, but he'd been there since birth. It was like the scales had fallen off his eyes and he was seeing the truth for the first time. The Christian devil was the ultimate puppet master of all humanity, and he'd been pulling the strings inside David since day one.
He was one of Satan's disciples since childhood, when his birth had inadvertently resulted in the death of his supposedly angelic birth mother. And it was the devil that had, from the age of 4 years old, little David Berkowitz playing with matches and intentionally starting fires. And all of the malice, and including his antagonism of the adoptive mother who had loved him so dearly, and his feelings of being responsible for her death because of all the stress and anguish he caused her through the 14 years that she had raised him from infancy until her death.
All that guilt he'd been carrying around for the death of both his adoptive and biological mothers, along with every fire he'd ever set, every fight, every malicious act, however minor, wasn't really his. It belonged to the devil, and that was a big relief. David Berkowitz had been saved from his own responsibility. No longer gung-ho on the military, David was now gung-ho on God, and he went in whole hog.
Every night it was a different program. Even in the church, they had a movie night. Another night was soul winning night. They showed religious oriented movies in the church. It was a big church, a 1,000 member church. And all these programs, when you got involved in it, every night was something happening at the church. And the higher you went in the church hierarchy, the more you had to go. After I was there for a while, I got higher. I was part of it. Put me in the bus program to work with the kids, you know, reading the Bible and stuff.
David Berkowitz was an accepted part of a community at long last. And as it turns out, it was a community that craved a lot of involvement. Quote, "At Beth Haven Church, I enrolled in every program. I went to church on Sunday, getting up at 6 a.m. I stayed in church from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. all day Sunday. I went to the Wednesday night service, the Thursday soul-winning outing, the Friday night meetings, etc. I listened to religious broadcasters continuously 7 days a week. I read dozens of religious books. I was enthralled with the doctrine of the apocalypse, the end of the world, and the everlasting punishment of sinners. Hell fascinates me." End quote. There's no question that David Berkowitz was fascinated by Christianity. Born again hard, as they say. In fact, he was so fascinated by it, he wanted everyone else to be fascinated by it too, and it was pretty much all he talked about back at the base. Quote, "I spent my days telling my peers and my superior officers of the need to be saved and the tragic increase in sexual immorality and permissiveness of our day," end quote. David Berkowitz had gone preaching, which I'm sure went over not at all, especially when applied to his superior officers, who I'm sure just loved being told what to do by a soldier in their command. In addition to the proselytizing he was involved in an extracurricular fashion down at the base, David was also engaged in soul-saving in an official capacity through the church, and spent entire evenings going around town handing out tracts and talking to people in the name of Christ.
Then there was that soul-winning night, then there was the witness day, we had to go to the shopping center to hand out tracts.
But as with all things Berkowitz, there's always that extra odd twist to make everything just a little bit weirder than it already was. For while the official mandate from the church was to attempt to save every soul, David Berkowitz had other, more selective ideas about who exactly should be saved, later confessing to only wanting to save some of the souls he was attempting to win over, specifically only the male ones. Quote, "I just wanted to see the men get to heaven. They're all hard-working, clean-cut men, patriotic men. Who the hell needed these sluts? These go-go dancers. Too many women in heaven would spoil it," end quote. After losing his virginity in Korea and briefly becoming a pacifist, David Berkowitz was now off women cold turkey and devoted himself single-mindedly once again to pointing every type of resentment toward them he could muster. No more physical contact, no more hanky-panky, no more missed chat, and no more of this conscientious objector peace and free love crap. David Berkowitz was back on hate. All while carrying around the good book and preaching the message of Christ, of course. As if he was always wearing a shirt that was just a little too small, David could never quite seem to cover every inch of his true self, and always a little corner seemed to show through no matter how hard he tried to cover it. David Berkowitz had sworn off women and was actively pointing his rage at them, but that didn't mean he wasn't still a sexual person, and that was something he still had to deal with, although he had a difficult time doing that, to say the least. A fellow soldier would later say of David, quote, "Whenever barracks banter about sex would come up, David would back off," end quote. David would say himself, quote, "Every day you would go back to the barracks. There would be 100 guys there. It was all so ridiculous. If we went to Louisville, there would be one girl and about 8 or 9 guys with their hands on her. So you had to find other stuff to do. Sometimes you kept to yourself and masturbated," end quote. I don't think it will come as a shock to anyone that David Berkowitz was a big auto-eroticizer. After all, you can't get rejected by masturbation, and for a guy with a lot of undealt with rage combined with an incredibly fragile ego, it was a safer option for all involved, and David was a big fan. Quote, "At 5 p.m. when the workday ended, I couldn't wait to get back to my room in the barracks and masturbate. Almost every waking moment, I find myself fantasizing, but I'm greatly troubled by my fantasies. They are all either sexual in nature or violent. I am really quite perverted," end quote. As if his particular concoction of confliction needed to be any more complicated, David Berkowitz was not only angry at women, harboring violent thoughts against them, all while desiring them sexually, he was also afraid of them, saying, quote, "I didn't think I could satisfy them. What I expressed verbally against the girls, they were whores and it was sinful to have sex, it wasn't what I felt. Strange, I felt hypocritical, but I couldn't help it. It was a need to do it. I was anxious that people should have a good impression of me," end quote. Even though it seemed those around him were at least partially aware of what might be going on inside him, at least at a subconscious level, due to the fact that in the army, David Berkowitz's nickname was Wolf, which on the surface was a reference to how hairy he was. But deep down inside, David feared it was due to others' observations of how he looked at women. So as David Berkowitz feverishly set about covering up his true feelings with his newfound conversion to Christianity, it seemed to satisfy him for a few months. But in the end, he discovered that you can't fill every hour of every day jerking off and hanging out at church. So eventually he grew tired of the grind and ended up going cold on that as well.
He tried to be a genuine contributing part of the church. He accepted what they told him, the message of Christian forgiveness and trying to do your best. But if you didn't, then, you know, it's because the devil was there and the devil had to be fought. But eventually he saw through it. He began to get bored and to realize that they just wanted to grow this organization and that he would never be more than an anonymous cog in this big megachurch organization, and drifted away from it.
I started to, even at the end, I started to sort of like, they call it backslide, you know, go back to your old ways, and I couldn't really handle that. I didn't want that. I didn't want all those restrictions. I wanted to enjoy life more and not be obligated to constantly be going to church, which was an every week thing.
The new car smell was starting to wear off. and being an active and voluntary part of a group for the first time in his adult life was a bit too much to bear. He was overcommitted, and he knew it.
The more advanced, the more they expected of you. So that you're, it was almost like being trapped, and you never got any pay for it. You had to do that in addition to your job, in addition to chores you had to do, washing and things that I had to do back at the barracks, wash my clothes and have them ironed, starched. I couldn't do those things. I didn't have time in it. Oh, you know, you understand what I'm saying. It was almost like a prison itself. I didn't want to live like that, so I just dropped out of it.
But it wasn't just the time commitment. This brand new ever-present threat of eternal damnation was starting to fuck with his head.
When you said you were backsliding, did you start feeling guilty about that?
Mm-hmm. And that threat of hell loomed in the air, hell, burning hell. It's really a scary thought, especially when it plays on an impressionistic mind or a person that's like got hang-ups, guilt feelings, unconscious guilt feelings or something. Or if a person is deliberately suppressing an act that they did, or a series of acts like they did, maybe had an affair or something. Boy, it's awful powerful. Because you know, nobody knows what's on the other side. And the threat for all these preachers saying, after you die, you'll be burning in boiling oil, you know, and fire. It's kind of scary. Because you see that they're serious. And then it plays on you, well, maybe there is burning hell there. And the next thing you know, you're all worried about, get right with God so you don't have to go there. Then you go into heaven. It's kind of scary.
So just like that, David Berkowitz was off God and out of the Christian church, saying later, quote, "When I worshiped God, it was out of terror," end quote. He was out on his ass, a tribe member with no discernible tribe to speak of. No longer a Christian, he didn't quite feel Jewish anymore either. Really, he never had. Now with two religions behind him, he had no one. Filled with rage, regret, and loneliness, he now knew how to operate a firearm. It was all burning down around him, but the worst was yet to come.
You got out of the, you were discharged from the Army from Kentucky?
Yeah.
Did you ever think about staying there?
I did, but I didn't know anybody but those religious people. And I wanted to stay in Kentucky. It was beautiful, beautiful state.
And you couldn't just stay there without...
You needed a job, church and a job. If I wanted to get a job down there, I'd have to be somebody's helper, and the only one that would give me a job is one of these church guys. In order for me to be his helper, I'd have to be going with him to church all the time, and he'd be like checking my attendance, you know. And there was this deadly cycle. That's why I just left it.
David didn't stay in the church. He didn't stay in Kentucky, and he didn't stay in the military either. On paper, things had gone well at Fort Knox. He had even won back the rank he lost in Korea and was once again a specialist E4. In fact, Berkowitz's performance was so good at Fort Knox, he became a prime target for reenlistment.
Why did you reenlist?
Oh, I didn't like the regimentation and things. It was a lot of petty stuff, you know. It wasn't anything like, I wanted something like with Audie Murphy or something, you know, that type of... Always, yeah, the action, yeah. But the regular army life, especially in the States, was dull, monotonous, and a lot of petty things I didn't care for.
Even though he was capable and he could focus on something long enough to learn what he wanted to get from it or what he thought he might find a value in it, he's a man with an extremely short attention span and really no sense of loyalty to anything except his own solitude.
Endlessly in love with his own anger, he could only take brief vacations from it. He knew that if he stayed, he would be ripped away from his one true love, as slowly and surely the isolation that protected his anger was methodically and unwittingly stripped away by those around him. This he could not have. So he returned to his anger once again, like a faithful star-crossed lover.
And you were out in 74?
Yeah, June of 74, 3 years.
And it was, what, about a year and a half? 2 years later before the crime started?
After I got out of the Army? The first violent crime was in July of 76. So 2 years later.
Prior to prison, Berkowitz's brief military career is the time period where we see him functioning the most, and by a long shot. After his honorable discharge in June of 1974, it's a pretty swift and serious descent into chaos for David Berkowitz. Quote, "When I came home, there was this other army. It was an army of rank and rules. This was an army that created chaos. This was an army dedicated to battle. It was not an army of good," end quote.
That thing he was born with, that got nurtured accidentally by his adoptive parents, and that he fed with acts of violence and malice throughout his life. By that time, the battle was lost. The only thing that would have prevented those homicides would have been his having the courage to see himself and take his own life. It was a pretty quick transition from Christian soldier to serial killer.
Next time on Killer Tape. As David returns to the Bronx with what would become the fundamental elements of the Son of Sam mythology firmly planted in his mind, he began to amass a personal arsenal to express his rage.
When I lived in the Bronx, I bought a shotgun. And within about a month after I got the shotgun, I used it on that dog. At this time, I bought that 45 caliber, they call it a machine gun. Actually, it was a semi-automatic rifle with a 30-shot capacity, rapid fire, you know. I didn't see the correlation in it myself, but at this time, I was starting to buy guns.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt, Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.